Are you looking for employment in the maritime industry but not sure where to search? Tired of sifting through all those other job listings, not finding the seagoing or shoreside jobs you're looking for? Well, it's time you logged on to jobs.gcaptain.com. That's right, jobs.gcaptain.com is your premier online source for maritime job listings. Search jobs, post your resume, set up personalized job alerts, even get free access to our career advice library. All from the new online job board for maritime professionals. jobs.gcaptain.com. And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is GCaptain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of GCaptain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles and in the studio with me is John Conrad. Welcome, John. How are you today?
Doing good.
This broadcast is for the week of June 9th, 2014. Listeners, this is the place we bring you the latest news and happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. Today, we will be talking about safety issues. This goes back to a subject that John knows a lot about because he wrote a book about it, the Deepwater Horizon incident. And apparently, a government report came out that is talking about how things have or have not improved in terms of safety and regulations since then. Before we get to that, John, first off, where has this year gone? June 9th already. We're almost at the halfway mark. We're at almost at the summer solstice, one of my favorite days of the year because it's the longest day of the year, June 21st.
Yes.
So I hear
summertime is here.
And with the solstice, we start doing crazy things. I understand you bought a new boat.
Yes, a mega yacht. Now, thanks to our GCAM listeners clicking on all our ads, we're now rolling in the dough. And I bought the most beautiful, well-maintained Lido 14.
A Lido 14, which
is
a nice little
14
bay,
feet.
Little bay racer, little 14-foot bay racer.
Yes.
And where did you get this boat? Did you go to a yacht broker down in Corona Del Mar somewhere?
Yes, named Craig. He has this list
that he puts
together.
One of the more prestigious yacht brokers on the West Coast, old Craig is.
Absolutely. Like I said, nothing but the best, considering our rolling in dough, as you know.
So is this a hidden plea to the listeners to please click more on some of those ads on the site?
No. Let our listeners do what they want. It's not a mega yacht, but I'm quite happy with my little Lido 14 that I restored with my son. My son's 8 years old, and my daughter's six, and wanted to take him out sailing. I have a larger boat, a 43-foot, but it's kind of hard to teach sailing on that. So I got this Craigslist boat that's been sitting in the backyard of someone's house, and, with a little weekend project with my son, and went on the boat. Our editor, the guy who puts together the podcast here, Mike McDonald, it's kind of been a team effort between us to get this thing back in pristine shape. So we did a little two-part, all gripping.
You did two-part?
Two-part, yes.
I hear there's been a little bit of debate in the bay, in Morro Bay here, with regard to two-part versus one part.
Yes, our friend Leonard Gentu owns a 72-foot burger, but the real mega yacht of the bay, and he's doing a one part application. I'm a big proponent of the two part all grip, and he lists the reasons. He said it's a lot less expensive than one part, but it also, I tell him, goes on thicker, so you have to use twice as much paint. So the one part's $100 a gallon. The two part all grip is about $250-$300 if you know where to shop. But it goes on so thin, you use a lot less paint. Anyway.
And doesn't rumor have it that you're supposed to spray the two-part?
Yes, you are supposed to spray
Did you roll or brush it on?
Problem with it has chemicals in it that are deadly if you spray. So in order to spray, you need a full SCBA, full mast and self-contained air pack. Which I guess I could have used my scuba gear, but it's not really OSHA approved.
Right.
So the option is to roll in, and it came out magnificent. If I do say so myself, it's got the sheen to it that makes it look beautiful. Well, so you can roll, but then you have to tip. It's roll and tip, the two part.
Well, very good. And listeners, thank you for indulging John and I on that little conversation there. It has been a hot topic here on the Bay the last week or two with the two-part versus the one-part. So, John, we are going to talk about safety issues today. I think you mentioned right before we started this broadcast, this is based on the recent government reports that came out. And is this in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon spill, or where are we going with this, John?
Yes, the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board has done extensive investigation into the cause of the Deepwater Horizon. We had the Coast Guard report, we had the Flag State Marshall Island report, we've had the drilling report, we've had countless reports. This is just the latest one from the CSB. But this one has taken a little bit of a step back. It says now that a few years have passed, what have the conditions improved in the Gulf of Mexico? This is a bit of a hot topic because many of our listeners rely or work in the offshore industry, and reports like this make them wonder, are their jobs safe? Will drilling continue in the Gulf of Mexico? So a lot of people are really nervous about this. We also have new rumors that have just, and not just rumors, but rigs have actually been starting to be stacked. So we are just coming out of a 5 to 10 year boom where the number of drill ships, I think in 2008 there were 38 drill ships in the world. Now in 2014 there are well over 100. So the size of fleet has grown exponentially in it with new jobs, new opportunities, salary. And now as financial cycles are cyclical, we tend to overbuild in the good times and underbuild in the bad times. Well, you know, questions are we pulling out of this excessive growth phase? And all answers point to yes. And they're starting to stack these rigs. And when it's a drilling term, to stack means just to pull the rig out of service. And so with new increased regulatory scrutiny, this new report saying, hey, maybe things aren't as safe as we thought. Maybe the Deepwater Horizon incident could happen again, accompanied with the kind of downward trend of the drilling industry in the last couple months, has a number of our listeners nervous.
And understandably so. So when in this report they talk about things not necessarily being safer, is the report more focused on environmental aspects or more focused on workplace aspects? And one of the reasons I asked this question, it's coincidental, just last night, I don't watch much television, but at nighttime sometimes when I'm pooped, maybe I'll have a little glass of whiskey on the rocks and flip on the old boob tube, as we call it, and do a little quick little channel surfing. The only premium channel I subscribe to is HBO, and on HBO they've got a program called Vice. I don't know if you've watch that program, but it's an expose type of program.
Our sister network, unofficialnetworks.com, is a ski site, and they worked with Vice in the early years of Vice when it was just starting.
Oh, nice.
Really interesting journalism that gets out into the worst places of the world.
Exactly. So they go out and they go on site to places all over the world and basically try and pick a topic and really dig deeply into that topic. And a place that they were recently was the Gulf Coast, and they were studying the lingering environmental issues from the Deepwater Horizon spill, because they were focusing mostly on this dispersement chemical that was sprayed by BP to disperse the petroleum.
Yes.
And they were focusing on the fact that that may not have been the most environmentally sound response. It may have been more based on PR. So I don't know if this report hits on the environmental aspects. What direction are you looking at, John, in terms of environmental or workplace safety?
This CSB report is about just the technical failures. They don't go into the effects of the oil spill, either of the human or the environmental effects. They're just talking about can it happen again? Can the technical failures happen again? Is their primary focus. But I would like to talk a little bit about the dispersant, the oil dispersant. Oil is a natural substance. If you go down to the beach here in Morro Bay, you will find tar balls on the beach. And one of the reasons is we don't drill anymore in California for new oil. And oil, when the pressure isn't relieved, naturally seeps into the ocean. And the ocean has a way of dealing with that. arguments, good arguments can be made for the fact that, okay, the ocean can deal with tar balls, but billions of gallons of oil spilled all at one time, the ocean does not have the resources to, and we can debate that. But the real question here is, why do they spray these man-made chemicals in the Gulf of Mexico? Oil is a natural substance, but then the real environmental effects are because we sprayed these into the Gulf, and that's the real concern. Some of those chemicals are starting to show up in shellfish, and people wonder, are clams good to eat and shrimp in the Gulf? And all that's debatable as well. But all these reports, the Vice TV and a lot of the reports you see in media, miss a critical fact. Why did we spray these dispersants? And we didn't spray them for PR. We didn't spray them in order to disperse, to eliminate the oil. The dispersants don't evaporate the oil. They just spread it out so it can naturally be absorbed better. But there was a very good reason why we used these, and I'd like to put it on the record why these dispersants were used. Well, how do we stop the oil spill? We put two new rigs right over the where the Macondo well was, and we drilled relief wells. We drilled down and kind of teed into the existing well, and then sucked the pressure up into the new well, and it relieved the pressure on the broken well. And in doing so, we stopped the oil from bubbling up. Well, all this oil was bubbling up right to the work area of where these ships were operating. And it wasn't just those two drill ships that were working at the time. There were also the oil boom vessels. There were also vessels that were supplying these two ships. There were also the vessels that were doing the thing like the top hat and trying the other things. And there were also the ROV vessels that were monitoring the well. So you had dozens of vessels in a very tight-knit area directly over the bubbling oil. Well, when the oil bubbled up, it let off gases. Where were those gases going? Into the rigs that were drilling these wells. So if they sprayed the dispersants to get the oil away from the working area, get it away from where people were trying to. So if we didn't spray the dispersants, we wouldn't have been able to drill the wells safely that ended the oil spill. And that's a small point, but one that is missed by a lot of these investigative journalism.
Interesting. Very interesting point. The cynic in me, and the older I get, the more cynical I get about things, really bought into the fact last night, and I didn't watch the show intently, I just kind of, you know, glanced at it for 5 or 10 minutes, but that's the part that I did pick up on. But the cynic in me believes that it would be very easy for me to believe that it was a PR issue, because the idea that was brought up last night was that, well, particularly in our culture today, out of sight, out of mind, and if they disperse this oil that is visible on the surface, even if it goes down below the surface and is in the top 80 feet of water or so, as far as a PR issue, it's gone. Mm-hmm. I trust your judgment, John, but I assume that the PR part didn't hurt as well along with that.
No, and we can debate whether they went overboard, whether they released more chemicals in the surrounding area than they needed to. But a lot of the chemicals that were released from like airplanes right on the surface of the ocean, those evaporated quickly. The real damaging one that's hitting the shellfish is the stuff that was released subsea. Mm. So they actually sunk pipes down to the ocean floor and released it along with the gas, and that had a time to mix as it bubbled up thousands of feet with the oil. It had time to mix with the ocean and get absorbed, and that's where the problems was. Well, it was only released subsea right at the rig, right at the zone, and that was specifically because of, well, they had to disperse the oil there in order to allow those rigs to operate.
Interesting. You know, it's funny. I'm glad that you brought this topic up today, because I was going to talk to you about this stuff anyway. So one of the things that I was thinking about this morning was, and I'm just going to jump right into it. I think I'm getting ahead of the ball here for us, but I want to jump right into it. You know, as mariners, we have a job to do. We work on the vessels. We work on the rigs. We're doing our job. How much culpability, however, do you feel that there is on the maritime industry? Do you feel that there's some responsibility for these types of environmental disasters? I was thinking even about the Valdez spill. Well, you know, it was a tanker. Those were mariners carrying product. I don't know if it's debatable how much fault there was on the captain's part there, but they're mariners carrying cargo, essentially, because of the petroleum companies drilling this stuff out of the ground. And then the consumer, with the great demand for this stuff and industry as well. So do you view the mariner as sort of a cog in the wheel, or do you view the mariner as a facilitator of something that is really potentially environmentally very damaging?
I view, you know, looking at the BP oil spill, I investigated heavily for my book and since and before that, and I knew a lot of the key players in the spill. And as I spent months researching and reading all the government reports and talking to firsthand witnesses, something became abundantly clear to me, and that is that no individual person did anything criminally, even negligent. No one wanted this. No one was mad and pressed a button. No one, you know, there are all these conspiracy theorists. Some say that a Chinese sub sent a torpedo into the, and that's all BS. All right. This was a accident that happened for very specific reasons, but no one, BP didn't, no one on the rig, no one at Transocean, no one wanted this incident to take place. This was an accident. Yet when you focus in on individuals, there's no criminal act, there's no criminal negligence, but as you pull away from the incident and see all of these individuals working together, well, there is a, you know, strong case to be made that BP or the drilling industry had some criminal culpability here. So it's more the culture of large corporations. And I don't even want to say BP, but this happens in every corporation. You look at latest release from Microsoft or even Apple, and you see products that fail miserably. The problem here is when a product fails miserably with BP, there's a major catastrophe. When Apple or Microsoft launches a product that fails miserably, well, they take a financial hit, but and maybe some ill will, but there isn't damage. So my stance is that BP does a lot better job than all other companies. But the structure of large companies in this country has some major flaws involved with it. And this CSB report talks specifically about the subsea, the BOP, the blowout preventer, that is meant to shear the pipe and close off the well in incidents. And this report says that it was actually closed a lot earlier than we thought, that the subsea engineers did a good job of closing this and that some of it worked better than we had thought it did. But there was a crimp in the pipe, and it goes into the whole reasons why. And they say now, if that same crimp happened, the current BOPs, that the new stuff that we've instituted, the new procedures and risk management that we've instituted since the BP oil spill, would not prevent the same incident from happening. So their take is it could happen again. My take is a little bit different. My take is, of course, it could happen again, but this isn't the primary cause of it. It wasn't just technical failure. These BOPs operate very well. They have an amazing track record, but only one failure can cause a major catastrophe. So organizations like Transocean and BP spend an incredible amount of money on these BOPs. I've seen $100,000 valves be ordered to replace, and not a blink of response from Transocean saying, oh, can you cut back our budget? We're going over budget. They really take care of these things, but they have to spend, as we get into deeper water, go after larger reserves, those BOPs spend a larger amount of time underwater. And they're not brought up to be inspected at the intervals that they used to be when we were plugging 30-day wells and then moving on to the next. Now that we're doing 6, 9, even 12-month wells, these BOPs are staying underwater and not being inspected at the rate. And why is that? You know, is there any one person that's saying, don't pull this up? No, it's the corporate culture. You know, there are 6 or 10 or 12 reasons why we don't pull up BOPs. And some of them are really safety reasons. If you're pulling up the BOP every 2 months, that's a dangerous operation. This is heavy equipment that's being pulled up. Can you hurt people? You know, and there's a focus. People say that BP was negligent and they didn't concern about safety. BP and Transocean spend more money on safety than you could possibly imagine, Jeff. It's incredible the amount of time, effort, the size of their HS&E departments, the care that they put into this stuff. However, their focus prior to the Deepwater Horizon, and it's changing now with risk analysis, but their focus prior to the Deepwater Horizon was on things, minor incidents, broken bones, death of one or two people, minor spills. They really weren't geared towards these large-scale disasters. They really didn't spend time or money thinking about it. And their theory was, and it's an interesting theory, unfortunately it's been proven false, but their theory was if you do the small stuff right, the big stuff will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. Well, my contention is you have to do both the small stuff and the big stuff right if you want the big stuff to take care of itself. But at the end of the day, it's still the human element. And that's why in my book, I don't go into the environmental, I don't go into the politics, I don't go into the corporate stuff. The book really looked at the people involved. And the last thing that the book says is that any of those individuals were culpable, you know, that they were criminals. I do not believe that. I think everyone at the individual level was putting in over 100% effort to try to prevent this. But they were working against communication problems with other departments in this corporate structure that really caused problems. But there were two, I don't really like doing this. I suggest if you want to know what happened, read the entire book. That's why I wrote 100, that book has 100,000 words, and because there's no simple explanation. That's my problem with a lot of these reports. The CSB report says, oh, it was the BOP, the crimp in the pipe. And they focus all this time and energy to fix that one problem. But it's like the Dutch boy with his finger in the dike. Unless you understand the broader problems here, you're not going to do anything.
Well, it also seems to go back to what you were just saying. It's focusing on a particular element, one of the smaller things or one of the components, as opposed to stepping back and looking at it systemically and looking at the large picture.
Yes. So, but I will give a little hint as to what the major problem here was. And if you want to fully understand, like I said, you'll have to read the book. But price of oil went, I think when I got out of college, one of my first ships was a super tanker up to Valdez, Alaska, that carried 1 million barrels of oil. And at that time, that was 2000, the price of oil, I remember, was $16, $17, maybe $18. And I remember thinking, man, I got $18 million worth of cargo right here. And I'm alone on the bridge. I just flip the wheel all over. I hit into that ship that's coming towards me. And there goes $18 million, plus all the cleanup costs. And I could easily cause a $100 million catastrophe. Well, then I left and I went with Transocean, and the price started going up. It hovered in the 20s, and then it jumped to 40, and then 60, and then over $100 a barrel it was at. And these companies started saying, well, the cost for us to build the deepwater ships and all of the subsea equipment, it comes to like $30 a barrel is the amount that they spend to extract, $30 to extract one barrel. Well, that doesn't really make much economic sense when it's $18, $28. They did it anyway, but they really limited their resources. But then when it shot up past 30, they started building more. And when it shot up past 100, we went on this crazy ride of building all of this new equipment. Well, you go to the shipyards in Korea, and it's amazing. They can build a billion-dollar drill ship in a year. Hmm. And I sat there. I was working for Pride. I was managing the Marine Department on the ship that was being built. And from steel showing up at the gate to launch and saying the farewells, it was 1 year. And it's incredible.
Yeah.
But how many years does it take me to get my license? It took 10 years of training to become a captain. And there weren't just captains or tool pushers and riggers and chief mates and stewards. And so it takes 1 year to build a billion-dollar ship, but it takes at least 10 years to train and develop a billion-dollar crew to run that ship. And when this huge expansion was happening, we were pulling mates and captains and drillers from land rigs and captains from tankers and giving them all the training and resources. And people say, oh, BP didn't spend, they don't care about training. They spend an enormous amount of money training these guys. But it's not all about books. It's about experience. And a lot of the crews did not have the experience. And it's not their fault. But the Deepwater Horizon had one of the best crews in the entire world for drilling. And they still did at the time of the incident, but a lot of their best guys were pulled off and put on new rig projects. They were sent to Korea, you know, and you've been on a rig for 10 years, and then they're building a brand new rig in Korea. You know, you lose a lot of guys to that. And some of them came back. The captain, Kirk Kutcha, had left to build a new rig for Transocean in Korea, the first one, and then he got pulled back to the Deepwater Horizon. So Transocean and BP were trying to plug the gaps. But when you double, triple the size of the fleet, where are those people coming from? That's one problem. The second problem is, as we go into...
Before you get to that second problem, John, let's take a quick break here to hear from our sponsor, because we're going at it. This is a great topic. But let's hear from the Teak Rail. We're proud to have the Teak Rail sponsoring our podcast here. They help pay some of the bills around here, so let's hear from them.
TheTeakRail.com features a collection of some of the best marine equipment on the market, from navigation and electronics to maintenance and galley. If you find it on TheTeakRail.com, you can bet it's the result of hundreds of hours of research and thousands of hours of abuse aboard vessels sailing the high seas. You need the gear, so why not get the right gear the first time? Log on to TheTeakRail.com and check out all the great gear from Motor, Sail, and Pro Mariners. All the best, most durable gear picked by the experts. TheTeakRail.com.
Thanks for sticking around, and welcome back, and thank you to the Teak Rail for being one of our sponsors. So, John, you were going to talk about the second reason.
Yes, I wanted to thank our readers for visiting the Teak Rail. I might be able to upgrade to a 16-foot boat or 18 if you click on those links.
There we go.
So what allows us to drill in deeper water, more complicated wells? You know, they say we only have enough oil reserves to last us another 20 years. You talk to the, you know, you read the Greenpeace report and they say we're running out of oil. Well, we're not running out of oil. We're running out of easy oil. There's plenty of oil down in the depths of the ocean. It's just difficult to get to. And but we also had this huge boom in technology. New computers, new systems that allow these rigs to do things that we never thought possible before. And these new systems are coming at an incredibly rapid rate. You know, 10 years ago, it was 14 years ago when I went to the graduated Fort Schuyler, or 20 years ago when I first entered as a cadet into these industry, we didn't have internet on ships. We didn't have GPS or Nectis on my first ship. We had a sat nav that came over twice a day and gave you one location. And we had a satellite phone, but it was $6 or $8 a minute.
Right.
And now in just 20 years, we have full internet on these ships and full phones and all this incredible technology. Well, a lot of that stuff's great, but it's not just the communication. We have new drilling technology that allows us to see 3D images, you know, a mile under the seafloor where we're currently drilling, and computes all of these. The largest supercomputer in the world was just built and sent to Houston. And it was built for drilling to decode the seismic data that comes from drill ships and the seismic tows. So there's a lot of technology that's going into this. So you have an incredible expanse of just the sheer number of rigs. So people being promoted at an incredible level. Used to be 20, 30 years before you get a captain job. And now, you know, I was offered my first captain job when I was 31, I believe, which is unheard of because they were building all these ships. So you have people jumping into, not before they're ready, but the second they're ready, they're being promoted in this industry. And there's not just them, but everyone under them is kind of working at their maximum level and struggling just a little bit with the job. Well, combine that, but that might be okay if that's all you focused on was your job. But with all this new technology, you have to focus on your job and learning all this new equipment. Mm. You have to learn the ECTIS. You have to go to training. You have to spend time with these seismic, you know, data things and the drilling engine. So you had this confluence of events, people working at their maximum level of experience and capability, some would even say a step beyond that. And you have this incredible amount of technology, which is complicated. And the technology does most of the heavy lifting, but it still has to be operated and the results interpreted by humans. So what was the cause of this deepwater horizon? If there was one thing, and there isn't, there are millions of things, but the biggest thing was these guys were overworked. They're overstressed. Mm-hmm. They're over. The companies were pushing them to train, do more. And overworked guys with overcomplicated technology. It's, you know, we're running away from simplicity mm-hmm. and towards this, these technological failures. Which gets the big question, are we safer now? And this CSB report doesn't worry me. Yes, the pipe was crimped, and yes, you know, we'll find a solution to that and we'll be safer. Yes, this incident could happen again with the same pipe crimp. There are things to be worried about in this report. But the biggest thing to be worried about, I think, is has any of this... have we slowed down the number of new builds? And the answer is, up until the last month, no, we continue to build these. And have we slowed down the pace of technology? No. So you have guys who are overworked and struggling with the training. But what's the government's response to the Deepwater Horizon? What do they say? Oh, you have all these lawmakers and all these things, and they all are saying one more thing. We need to increase regulations. And we need to increase safety procedures. What does that translate to the average mariner, the cog in the wheel? It translates to these guys are already working at their maximum, and now you have just doubled the amount of paperwork they have to fill out. Mm-hmm. All these regulations require someone to fill out the reports, fill out the paperwork, talk to the inspectors. So you're pushing these guys who are already pushed to the limit further.
And on top of that, just the frustration of having bureaucrats and administrators, people that generally aren't out in the field, coming up with a whole new laundry list of quote-unquote safety regulations.
Yes.
You know, and they may not be really applicable to day-in and day-out performance.
Now, on top of that, what did I say? We are already stretching the amount of technical ability these guys can. You can only learn so many systems in a year. Well, what's the government saying? Well, we need more equipment on the BOP. We need an extra set of valves. We need these remote sonic things that you can press the shear rams and from the lifeboat and close it. And you need all of this extra equipment. And what's technology's or solution? Everything will be okay if we just come up with a new technology that'll be able to fix this. Well, that new technology, someone has to learn it. Someone has to train. And they're not giving us more crews. They're not giving us more specialists in this equipment. They're using the crews that exist there. So a lot of our listeners are going to be worried to hear this. I'm probably going to get some hate mail, and I've gotten worse than that over the book. But are we safer? I'm not sure is my answer. But it's not for the reasons of the Chemical Safety Board. It's for the reason that the government doesn't realize the basic problem here is not these small technical failures. The answer is not better shear rams. The answer is not more regulations, more inspections, government reports on the shear ramps. The answer here is we got to relieve the mariners. And hopefully the market is going to take, if we pull back the number of ships, well, those experienced guys are all going to be pushed down the ladder one. And I our readers, no one wants a demotion. No one wants to worry about their job. But there could be a silver lining to that that solves this whole problem. But right now, I think that these reports, these solutions are the problem. It's not the guys on the rig. They're doing an excellent job. So we got to give them a break. And frankly, all this paperwork, all these reports that you're doing, all this new technology, is just making the average guy's job harder. And that is dangerous, in my opinion.
So the intent of these kind of reports that were just put out, of course, are to make a safer environment all around. But you're actually saying that it may just be doing just the opposite.
Yes.
Very interesting. So well, I've got a couple of thoughts. One is that the millions upon millions of barrels of petroleum that are pumped and distributed every single day, the incident rate of accidents is just so small. So when something happens, particularly these high-profile events like the Valdez or the Deepwater Horizon, of course, the media goes crazy and the regulators go crazy, the politicians go crazy. So there is probably really an inordinate amount of response. The response really is probably out of balance with the actual incident, just because there's such high-profile incidents. So I just think looking at it from a percentage of accidents and errors that happen, I think just on its face, the industry is doing a great job in terms of safety. And here's the second thought that came about when you were discussing this, is the profit motive. And you actually illustrated a paradox with regard to the profit motive. Now, when we get regulators that come in and write a report like this, they're driven by usually, really, if you think about it, self-serving motives. I mean, it's not entirely altruistic. They're doing it because they are part of a department of the government. And in order for them to have their job security, they've got to go out and they've got to find fault. And if they don't find fault, well, they really have to sort of almost create it. Now maybe I'm going to get some hate mail here, John, but you know, that's job preservation on their side. So it's a little bit at odds with the industry that in that regard. And that's not just specific to the maritime
industry.
Millions
of dollars of money, millions of dollars to investigate these.
Right. So the interesting thing, though, is looking at their motive versus the profit motive. When you look at a company like BP, you know, this is their golden goose. They are driven by the profit motive to have the safest, most productive workforce and environment out there. But then, ironically, and here's where the paradox of the profit motive came in, you mentioned, too, though, in terms of productivity, as the boom was going on with higher oil prices, stretching that labor pool maybe a little thin, or expecting a little bit too much out of that labor pool. So on one hand, the profit motive is self-regulating, and that's one of the great things about capitalism and economics, is with that profit motive, it's in the best interest of the corporation to maintain the safest standards. But at the same time, they want to increase profits as much as possible, and there are times when those safety issues can be stretched a little bit because of that.
Yes, and there's one more. Why are we doing all this complex technology? Why are we need all these new computer systems and rigs and stuff doing this? It's complexity. Complexity is the problem. Because we've sucked all the oil out of Gulf of Mexico. In order to do it, we have to go into deeper, more dangerous water. However, right off the coast of California, there's a lot of oil that we can get at simply, but we're not allowed to drill for it. So we can easily do this safely if we do go after the simple. You know, we got to take a notch back from complexity. It's the same thing as the financial crisis. Why did that happen? That happened for the same exact reason. in order to push these profit motives, we had to come up with more complicated derivatives and things that people really didn't understand. The computers analyzed it, but at the end of the day, it was an analyst who goes, I don't know.
Right.
And why did we do that? Because the government won't let the Wall Street expand the simpler financial things. They're so heavily regulated that the only way the Wall Street can get some freedom is to do something new that the government doesn't quite understand yet.
Right.
But going back to your first point, yes, you know, what's the number one killer of people in emergencies, whether it's fire, explosion, or what kills more people than anything else?
I don't know, mate.
It's panic. Oh. Why do people die in a fire? You know, you have a fire in your house. You get down on hands and knees, and there is always oxygen at the lowest level. Mm. Sometimes you got to press your lips down to the floor. But if you stay cool, calm, collected, you can get out of almost any danger. Okay. That's what we're doing now with the Deepwater Horizon. There are solutions. We can figure out this problem. We can get safer. But the government and the voters are panicking. And what do you do when you panic? You try to do it too much in a condensed amount of time. You try to jump up and jump out of windows or whatever you do, and that's essentially what we're doing here. You know, I believe the government regulators are panicking a bit, and reports like this fuel the panic. And you know, that's where we get into danger.
Interesting. Well, we've raised some provocative points today, and listeners, particularly those of you that are out in the Gulf Coast or working on rigs throughout the world, we'd love to hear from you, your opinions on this. Do you feel that you are being overworked or stretched for the profit motive of the large corporation? Or do you feel that, well, you're doing an appropriate level and you're playing an appropriate role within the corporation to serve that profit motive? A very interesting concept.
Yeah, so do you think the new regulations are helping, or are they... putting a lot of hassle on you, preventing you from going out on deck and doing what you need to do?
Yeah. Very interesting stuff, John. So we're about out of time for today. So we'll take your closing comments.
It's a complicated issue, but at the end of the day, it comes down to a simple solution. The government's doing all these reports and new investigation, new regulations, and new paperwork you got to fill out, new technology, which is complex, and all this problem. But they're not doing the one thing that's going to prevent the next oil spill. And then one thing that's going to prevent the next oil spill is very simple. And it frustrates the heck out of me that they're not doing it. And it's go on the rigs and ask the guys who are there what they need.
Yeah.
You go to the tool pushers and say, what's going to make this? They'll tell you. They'll tell you these regulations are causing them, all this paperwork is causing them to be in their office and not in the rig. They'll tell you that a lot of this technology is BS. They'll tell you exactly what's wrong, but we're not listening. So it's a very simple solution. We don't need analysts and government reports and investigators dying through. We need to go on the rig and talk to the captains, the tool pushers, and say, hey guys, what do you need to be safer? And they'll tell you.
Yeah. Excellent point, and I can't help but agree with you. All right, John, good stuff and some provocative stuff. So listeners, shoot us an email and let us know what you think. Feel free, of course, to post on the board as well. Anything else before we sign off, John?
No, a lot of new jobs on the job board, so check that out.
Very good. Well, thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week to keep up with what's going on in the maritime and offshore industry. On behalf of John Conrad and myself, Jeff Eccles, we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Be well and be safe.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. G-Captain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.